Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. And these are the ordinances that you shall place before them. OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Mishpatim. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 25th day of Shavat, 5776, corresponding to February 4th. Let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, and then we'll get down to business. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tehyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai mi'ya'amod ki imcha hasalicha l'ma'an tivare. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yorachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'miafela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv Vinomar Amen. Before I forget, this Shabbat we bench Rosh Chodesh. So on Shabbat, the announcement will include that Rosh Chodesh Adar Rishon will be on Tuesday and Wednesday next week. Adar HaRishon means that we already know that there are two Adars, but let me sort of briefly describe to you how it used to be, how it will be, and how it could be. Originally, the system, which I call Plan A of God's, was to have Jewish involvement, people, human involvement in the process of making the calendar. And this includes two separate issues. It includes determining which day begins each month, Rosh Chodesh, and sanctifying that day as Rosh Chodesh, and periodically intercalating the year by adding an extra month before the month of Nisan. So today we have a fixed calendar where the months are calculated by mathematical formula and various rules, and do not currently rely on sighting of the new moon, do not rely on the pronouncement of a Sanhedrin, which unfortunately we do not have. And the months go one after the other by the patterns and the rules according to average calculation of the time it takes the moon to go through its phases. As far as the years are concerned, since the purpose of adding a month periodically was to maintain Pesach, Passover, in the spring and Sukkot in the fall, but mostly the focus is on Pesach, it was calculated that adding a month during 7 out of 19 years would accomplish the job. And a pattern was established that in any given cycle of 19 years starting from creation. You have a regular year, and then a shana mu'uberet, a pregnant year carrying an extra month. The third year of the cycle, 6, 8, 11, 14, 17, and 19. But in the time of Sanhedrin, that's all Plan B. The fixed calendar is Plan B without a Sanhedrin. And I keep adding the word, unfortunately, lida'avonenu, because we're supposed to have a Sanhedrin. But we lost it. And when we get it back, we go back to Plan A. Plan A, I'm not going to discuss, I have in the past, the issue of the months, but I will talk briefly about this extra month. A committee of judges from the Sanhedrin would meet sometime after Rosh Hashanah and examine data of the vernal equinox and the scheduled date for Pesach. Coming closer to that season, they would check meteorological sources for whether the winter is going to be a harsh, long winter or a lighter, short winter, how much rain, how much snow, how the flocks of sheep and goats are doing for producing lambs and kids to be used as Korban Pesach, how the condition of the roads. There were many, many factors, some more than others, some higher priority than others. And a pronouncement sometime during Adar was made that the coming month will not be Nisan, but will be another Adar. This pronouncement could be made by Sanhedrin any time from Rosh Hashanah on. If they say something before Rosh Hashanah, which means not during the current calendar year, it has no value. If a pronouncement by Sanhedrin is made any time from Rosh Hashanah until the beginning of Nisan, then the extra month is added. The extra month is another Adar. In fact, there are books that call them Adar and Ve'adar. We tend to call them either Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni, or Adar Aleph and Adar Bet. First Adar, second Adar, because we know in advance that they're going to be two or not. So we have no problem this Shabbat, which is the 27th day of the month of Shvat, to already announce Rosh Chodesh Adar Rishon, because we know this year is the 19th year of a 19-year cycle, and it is scheduled to have an extra month, and so it will. And we have an Adar Rishon and an Adar Sheni. But in the time of Sanhedrin, past and future, the decision could be made from as early as Rosh Hashanah, but in most cases it was made in the beginning of Adar. Now that's important because Adar's main feature is Purim, and Purim has to be exactly 1 month before Pesach, and that means that if you have an Adar and you're in the middle of the Adar, and it comes the 14th and the 15th in Yerushalayim, and you celebrate Purim, and then a day later, a week later, the Sanhedrin announces that the next coming month is not Nisan, but another Adar, then you have Purim all over again in that Adar, which is now a month before Nisan. So that's an unusual situation, but it could occur. It's out of the question when it comes to our fixed calendar. Our fixed calendar is much neater, less prone to headache, but much less desirable in God's eyes, because he wanted the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, to be active partners in setting up the Jewish calendar month by month and holiday by holiday. That means we take it into our hands, and God's reason was simple. He said, Shabbat, I made. I created the world in 6 days, and I rested on the seventh, and I, therefore, have sanctified the seventh day and command you to make it holy. But I am the one who sanctified Shabbat because I created the world. But you were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and you were taken out of Egypt by me, says God, in order to become a nation, and you receive the Torah, and the Torah includes holidays which belong to you, the Jewish people, and you have to sanctify the dates that determine the sanctity of those holidays because they're yours. In any event, we announce this Shabbat that Rosh Chodesh Adar Rishon, or Adar Aleph, will be Tuesday, which is the 30th day of Shvat, and Wednesday, which is the first day of Adar Rishon. Hope that's clear. Now let's get into the Sedra stuff. Torah-wise, let's go back to the beginning and bring us up to date as quickly as we can. Bereshit, the book of Genesis, has 12 weekly portions, none of which are ever combined. And during that range, within that range, there are a total of 3 mitzvot out of 613. It's simple to say, and obvious to say, that the book of Bereshit is not primarily meant to teach us mitzvot, but to teach us about the beginning of the world, the flood, our patriarchs and matriarchs, the tribes, meaning the sons of Yaakov, and all the things that happen, lessons of how to behave and lessons of how not to behave. We then get to the book of Shemot, Exodus, where the first 2 weekly portions out of 11 are Shemot and Va'era, also no mitzvot, and they are to tell us about enslavement in Egypt, the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu, the future Redeemer, the intensification of the oppression and servitude, and the beginning of the redemption in the form of the first 7 of the 10 plagues. Then we get to Parshat Bo. Parshat Bo had 20 mitzvot, which so far that's a lot. And they are all related to the Exodus, which is the theme of Parshat Bo. So they become mitzvot that are contextual, and they are sort of not byproducts, but co-products of the story. In Bishalach, 1 single mitzvah, that of the Shabbat boundary, mostly story of the miraculous crossing of the sea, the splitting of the sea, the drowning of the Egyptians, the song of the sea, the miracle of water, the miracle of heavenly food, and at the end of Bishalach, the battle against Amalek. Comes Yitro with the description of the Sinai experience, and we have 17 mitzvot, 14 of which are part of the 10 commandments. The other 3 come at the end of the Sedra. But those are the fundamental 10. I really got to be careful how I describe them. Don't want to describe too long why I have to be careful in describing them, but they are chapter headings for what comes next. Then we come to this week's Parsha of Mishpatim, and we have an explosion of mitzvot. Within an average length Sedra, we have 53 out of the 613 mitzvot, and a lot of them are very down-to-earth, practical rules and regulations for the functioning of society. Now, what I want to say, which I've said many times in the past, and this year, let's put it in the context for a moment of marble cake. In Hebrew, ugat shayish. I had this thing in my head about a marble cake, and I went to the internet and I checked recipes for it. And basically, it goes like this. You make a batter with your regular cake ingredients, and then you divide it in two. And in one of the halves, you mix in cocoa powder to make it chocolatey. And the other one, you leave alone, or you add vanilla flavoring, whatever. Now you take the batters, and you do not mix them, because that would make like a light chocolate cake. But you swirl them around a little bit so that the white part of the cake and the black part of the cake, the chocolate part of the cake, stay distinct, but they are, I don't know what the right word is, not mixed with each other, but intertwined with each other. And that's a marble cake. You cut it, slice, very attractive, the black and the white on the same slice, and each slice is a little different. Anyway, why do I bring it up? Because the Torah did that with two very significant pieces that we had last week in Yitro and this week in Mishpatim. First, you have the wondrous, magnificent, awe-inspiring experience at Sinai. That includes the preparation for Sinai when the people reached Midbar Sinai and then camped at the foot of the mountain, and the rules for the three-day period before they received the Torah, and hearing the divine voice, whatever exactly that means, and all of the wonders of that whole Sinai experience. And then you have rules and regulations for the functioning of society, which is a prerequisite, or at least a co-requisite, of every other mitzvah, because that's how we live. We function as a society, and as individuals, we have rules and regulations of the Torah which we have to follow. There are things that are between us and God, and there are between things that are interpersonal, which are also between us and God, but they also involve other people. We can call that, for lack of a better term, the mundane nitty-gritty of Jewish life, as opposed to the lofty, wondrous, miracle-filled, awe-full and awe-inspiring experience of something like what happened at Sinai. So what does the Torah do after the splitting of the sea and the song of the sea and the water that came from a rock and the food that came from heaven in the form of the manna? We have, at the beginning of last week's Seder, which we discussed last week, you have a story of Yitro, Moshe's father-in-law, coming to visit his son-in-law. He brings his daughter, Moshe's wife, and his grandchildren, Moshe's sons, to be reunited with their father, who's been busy with the people. And he wants to know what his father-in-law does for a living, what his son-in-law does for a living, so to speak. And he watches how the people interact with Moshe and asking him questions and bringing disputes before him. And the father-in-law, like many fathers-in-law will do, puts in his two cents about how to make a more efficient job of what he's doing, so the people won't get upset, so he won't be so tired. A system of courts, lower courts, middle courts, higher courts, and final decisions come to Moshe. And then we have the Sinai experience. And then we have Ve'ela HaMishpatim Asher Tasim Lifnehem. These are the ordinances, the statutes, which you shall present to the people. Now, you compare, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, which Rambam and others say is the mitzvah, the command to believe in one God. And then you look into Mishpatim, and you have a totally different mood or flavor of mitzvah, of what happens when my car goes out of control and does damage to the fence of your property, and who has to pay for it? Or my dog digs up your rose bush, causing you financial damage, and I have to take him to the vet because of injuries from his digging up your rose bush, and that costs me money, and we go to a court to find out who is responsible for all of the bills. That's part of Torah. That's specifically presented in Mishpatim. And it most reasonably follows the account of Yitro's visit, and especially his looking after his son-in-law to see how things go. Then we get to the end of Parshat Mishpatim, and you read the continuation of the story of Revelation at Sinai. It didn't finish in Parshat Yitro. It continues at the end of Parshat Mishpatim. And very significantly, it says there, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, God says to Moshe, come up the mountain again and be there with me, and I will give you the tablets of stone and the Torah and the mitzvah, which I have written to teach them. We'll talk more about that, but the point, getting back to marble cake, is that's what you see in Yitro and Mishpatim. Take chapter 18 of Shemot. Move it to the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more on Parshat Mishpatim. Take the end of Parshat Mishpatim and attach it to the end of Parshat Yitro, and you have two distinct situations. You have Revelation at Sinai, and you have the down-to-earth practical mitzvot of day-to-day Jewish life. Those are the two halves of the batter of the cake. But what the Torah did, what God did in the Torah, is take a spatula, so to speak, and just stir a little so that part of Mishpatim precedes, for its own reasons, which we discussed last week, the Sinai experience, and part of the Sinai experience comes after all of the Mishpatim, because the product is a very important improvement or lesson-filled marble cake of Torah. Pardon me for running away with the analogy, with the metaphor, because what is Torah? Not just the Ten Commandments, not just belief in God and prohibition of idolatry and not murdering and not stealing and bearing false witness and everything else there, but it is every single down-to-earth mundane issue, to the point where the word mundane does not exist in the Jewish Torah lexicon, because there is nothing that's mundane. It is all holy and spiritual. That is a message of Judaism, and that is a description of a beauty of Judaism. The extreme example, the ultimate example that I always like to use when I'm talking to people who don't really get the whole idea of Torah Judaism, is that there is a blessing to be recited after successfully using the bathroom. That, if you are not aware of that should blow you away, because most people think of religion in the context of the synagogue, the church, the mosque, holy events, holy temple, but down to the everyday nitty-gritty of life, even including going to the bathroom? You mean there's a blessing for that? Yes, not only is there a blessing for that, it is a very important blessing. It's a blessing that by which we recognize that God has created the human being in a complex way, with things that are supposed to be open and things that are supposed to be closed. And if any of those closed things open or open things close, we can't function before God, and we can't function at all. So when one relieves himself in the bathroom, he says to God, after washing his hands and leaving the bathroom, he says, "Thank you that I am functioning physically in a proper way, and I owe you one. And I will pay it off in my endeavor to learn Torah, to practice mitzvot, and to be a good person." So that's the whole story in a nutshell. And then what's left to learn is all of the detail, of which we will get a smattering in a moment. You're standing in front of a grocery store when a friend of yours comes by on his bicycle. And the store has this no bikes allowed inside the store policy. So he says, "Can you do me a favor? Keep an eye on my bike. I'm just going in for a container of milk and I'll be right out." So you say, "Sure," and you watch the bike, and he goes into the store and he buys his milk and he comes out. In the meantime, two big bad guys came, pushed you to the ground, and stole the guy's bike. So when he comes out, he is surprised to find you a little bruised up, and more surprised maybe to find his bicycle missing. And he said, "What happened?" He said, "You say these two guys pushed me and stole your bike. Who bears the cost of replacement?" This is a classic issue called Shomer Chinam, a guardian who is not being paid for being a guardian. And Parshat Mishpatim, among many other topics, deals with what are classically known as the four Shomerim, the four guardians. They include the situation I just described. They include the borrower. They include the Shomer Sachar, who's getting paid for watching something, and the socher, the one who is renting something. Now, I didn't answer the question in a moment. I will answer the question in a moment, but let's just throw in a whole bunch of other things and see what's going on here. "Can I borrow your bike?" Guy says, "Sure, here." And you drive it off. You say, "I'll be back in a half an hour." So he lent you his bicycle, and you're riding for half an hour. The similarity between "can you keep an eye on my bike when I go into the store" and "can I borrow your bike?" "Sure." The thing that is the same is that the bike belongs to one person and it is temporarily in the hands of a second person. The difference is that in the first case, as Shomer Chinam, the benefit of the fact that one person has the property of the other for a period of time, the benefit is to the owner of the bicycle. In the case of the shoel, the borrower, the benefit is to the one who borrowed it. So that makes them different. And in fact, if the borrower says, "Two guys came, pushed me off the bike, and stole your bike," the borrower has to pay for the bike. Whereas, which I didn't answer yet, the Shomer Chinam, you who are doing your friend a favor outside the store, do not have to pay him for the bike. because a Shomer Chinam is not liable for theft, and the Shoel is. It's a little bit more complicated because when you have a full court system, this issue would be handled by a lower court of three judges, and they have the power to administer an oath to you, the guy that was watching the bike, that you were not negligent, that you didn't leave the bike standing there and walk away or turn your back and talk on your cell phone. If you are willing to swear before the court that you exercised due diligence in watching the bike, but you were overcome by these two bullies who pushed you, then you're free. In the borrower's case, it almost doesn't matter where the bike is and what happened to it. He's going to be responsible. The one factor that he will not be responsible for is normal wear and tear. And that has a special term when it was not a bicycle, but an ox or a horse that you borrowed from someone. But I'm just giving you a little tiny flavor of the complications that are addressed by a court and the overall topic of Shomerim. Basically, the common feature to all four of them, as I described before, is an item belongs to one person and it's in the hands of another person. However it got into those hands makes a difference. I asked you to watch it. I paid you to watch it. You rented it from me. You borrowed it from me. They all have differences. But the common feature is it's my item, and you are temporarily in possession of it in an acceptable reason. You didn't steal it. You borrowed it. You rented it. I asked you to watch it. I paid you to watch it. Those are the classic four Shomrim. Now, there is a Mishnah which I've always enjoyed in Masechet Bava Metzia, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Bet. Basically, it outlines the following. A owns a cow. He rents it to B for the purpose of B's plowing his field. And during the time that the cow is in the possession of B, B lends it to C. And when it's in C's possession, it dies. Not in the course of working, but it just died, and a veterinarian who examined the carcass is willing to testify that it was natural causes. The Mishnah describes a very strange situation that results. Again, A owns the cow. He rented it to B. B rented it from A. B lent it to C. C borrowed it from B. And in C's possession, it died of natural causes. That's called Meta Kedarka. The rule is that C has to pay for the cow. And since he borrowed it from B, he has to pay the value to B. Meanwhile, B is exempt from paying A because when an animal dies of natural causes in the hands of a renter, he does not have to pay for it. If you get the picture so far, the first opinion in the Mishnah is that A's cow went to B, went to C, died in C's hands. C has to pay B for it, and B does not have to pay A for it. Comes Rabbi Yossi, mentioned in the Mishnah, and says, how are we to allow B to profit from a cow that belongs to A? It's not fair. But C should pay A for the cow. Now, here's why I'm bringing this up. This second suggestion is a very fair suggestion. It's A's cow, and it died, and C is responsible, and he should pay A. The problem, for the moment, the problem with that is that C borrowed it from B, and he has to pay B. B rented it from A and is exempt from paying in the case of dying of natural causes. So you can say from today till tomorrow, this is not fair. How can B profit from a cow that belonged to A? But if you follow the strict technical guidelines of Jewish law, which we are duty-bound to follow, then C must pay B, and B is exempt from paying A. Rabbi Yossi came and said, it's not fair. And he gave a different suggestion, which can't work unless we re-examine the situation and identify it differently. In fact, Rabbi Yossi HaGlili's opinion, Rabbi Yossi's opinion, says the following. Can B lend a cow that he rented from A to C without A's permission? The answer is no, he can't. Take a modern example of this, which is why I love these Mishnayot and Gemaras, because as ancient as they are extremely modern if you just show them in a different light. You rent a car. You're listed as a driver. You can't let someone else drive it. And if he does and there's an accident, the insurance is not going to cover it. You're going to be held responsible. If someone else is listed as a driver, that's a different story. But if you're the only driver listed, you can't let anyone else drive it because they won't be covered by the insurance and by the agreement, the rental agreement. That happens with oxen, and it happens with cars, and it happens with everything in between. You rent an ox or a cow to pull a plow on a normal field, and you use it instead on a hillside incline where it's extra strenuous for the animal and land that hasn't been plowed yet and stones and boulders that the plow has to uproot. It puts a strain on the cow, and if it dies, you're responsible because you misused the terms of the rental. But let's get back to our case. Says Rabbi Yossi, says his opinion, and those who explain his opinion, if B cannot lend the cow to C without A's permission, which he can't, then we will say B is not lending the cow to C. B is the agent, the shaliach, for A in lending the cow to C, which in essence means that it is A that lent the cow to C. A rented the cow to B, but during that time, with A's permission, that the cow was lent to C, C becomes a borrower from A. And therefore, if the cow dies of natural causes and C is responsible to pay, he has to pay A. I don't know if it's yet understood why I am, as my mother, Olei HaShalom, would say, hocking you a chinik about this, but I want to make sure the point gets across. The fact that something is not fair, but technically accurate, means that in most cases it will end up not being fair. And you can't just change things around and make it fair without a halachic basis for it. Because if you tamper with the technicalities of the details of Jewish law, then the whole structure crumbles. But if you have a legalistic way of reformulating what's going on, in order to make things fair, go for it. That's my point. Now let me change the issue to something totally different where the result is not as neat. By the way, the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi, that C has to pay A. Now remember, all of the above is as much part of Torah as keeping Shabbat and believing in God. It's part of believing in God. And Shabbat is an acknowledgement that God created the world and is in charge of everything, so it's all part of the same Torah. But when you put it in daily down-to-earth things, you have to understand that this is all part of what was revealed to the Jewish people by God and Moshe after the Sinai experience, at the Sinai experience and thereafter. Give me another case. You go into a electronics store and you buy a large screen TV with all of the bells and whistles. And it costs 2,000 shekel. And you pay the guy, oh, this is the last day of a sale. 2,000 shekel today, tomorrow it goes back to its regular price of 2,750. So you come in, and you say, I'd like to buy it. The guy says, you're lucky, it's the last day of the sale, and it's the last one we have. You give him a credit card or check or cash. Let's not get involved in that, because there are differences. For 2,000 shekel, and he gives you a receipt. You say, I can't really carry this home today because I'm riding by bus. Tomorrow I'll have my car and I'll pick it up and take it. Is that okay? And the guy says, fine, no problem. You come the next day with your car, with your receipt in case he doesn't remember the purchase. And the guy hands you back 2,000 shekel and says, I don't have the TV anymore. What did he do? The day, the morning before you came, it had gone back to its regular price of 2,750 shekel, and a guy came in and bought it. So the guy says, hey, 750 shekel, I'll give the guy back his 2,000 shekel when he comes to pick up the TV, and I make myself the extra money. So you come and say, what are you talking about? Here's my receipt. I paid you the money. It's mine. He says, technically, it's not yours until you take physical possession of movable merchandise. It doesn't belong to you yet. Yes, you paid for it, and yes, you got a receipt, and more than that, you gave your word to buy it and your money. The storekeeper gave his word that he was selling it to you, and he changed his mind. So you bring him to court, and you say, I want that TV or its equivalent for 2,000 shekel. The guy says he never made a physical acquisition, in Hebrew, a kinyan, by picking it up, and therefore it was technically not his yet. And I did what I did, and I gave him back his 2,000 shekel, so I shouldn't have to pay any more. This goes before the court, three people. And they say to you, unfortunately, the guy is technically correct. The language in the Shulchan Aruch is, Ma she'asa asui. What is done is done. Aval. Listen to me carefully now. Aval lo asa ma'ase Yisrael. The seller did not behave like a proper Jew. A proper Jew gives his word, and his word is his bond, as the expression goes, and he had no right, no, I can't say right, he had no business selling that TV that morning. But he did, and technically what is done is done. The Shulchan Aruch is not finished with this guy. I guess I am, because I'm out of time. I'm even over time, going to have to cut something out. So let's leave it as he did the wrong thing, but sometimes a technicality allows him to get away with it, but not really, because the court will put out the word that this is how this guy behaves, and he'll probably lose business, so he won't want to do it. Point of all of this is everyday down-to-earth life is as much part of Torah as anything contained in the Ten Commandments, which we heard at Mount Sinai. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameach.